This is Wade Rathke. It's Friday morning. That means it's Wade's World on KABF 88.3 on your FM dial. www.kabf.org if you're live streaming. And this is 100,000 watts of people power broadcasting from Little Rock, Arkansas throughout much of the state. We'll be live streaming, and by early next week, there'll be a podcast. At Wade's World, we talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today, we're talking to Victor Minotti, who's the executive director of the International Forum on Globalization. We're going to talk about something interesting here in Arkansas, the Keystone XL pipeline, and even more so, the Koch brothers. Welcome, Victor, to Wade's World.
Victor? Good morning.
Okay.
Good morning.
We had a little delay. We're calling between San Francisco and Little Rock and New Orleans today. Victor, you all just did a dynamite report. Tell people first, what is the International Forum on Globalization? Let's jump into the mess.
Well, we were formed we're actually in our 20th year right now. We were formed by leaders of social movements from around the world who were concerned with the creation of the North American Free Trade Agreement and the World Trade Organization back in the mid-90s. And so IFG was created as sort of a space, first of all, for learning for some of the key people who were trying to understand these trends, what they meant for inequality, for democracy, for the environment. And then we began to do public education about these things, helped to get things going, like those street protests, the Battle of Seattle that happened in 1999 that stopped the WTO from launching its new round. A lot of big battles and global rulemaking like that we've been involved in over the years. And now, because globalization's extreme concentrations of wealth and power have put, plutocrats in charge, there's been a shift in power. Not that corporations are not any more powerful, they're more than ever, but what we're seeing now is the emergence of these, we call them oligarchs even, like Charles and David Koch, who have so much personal wealth, they're able to assert that in new forms of political power that we just haven't seen before on the American landscape.
Now, in Arkansas, obviously, a lot of people know both about the Koch brothers and about Keystone XL, partially because of a year ago, there was an oil spill in Mayflower, Arkansas, which is, it's not even 30 miles away from downtown Little Rock, probably more like 20-something. So all of a sudden, the people in Arkansas got a quick lesson in what oil tar sands are really like from Canada. And, of course, the Koch brothers, because there's a race for U.S. Senate involving United States Senator Mark Pryor, they're all on the airwaves paying for a lot of attack ads. So you're looking at both of these two things, right? Both the Keystone XL pipeline and the role of the Koch brothers. Tell us how that works.
Well, we're curious what the connections were. So for the past year, we've been digging and began by mapping their assets of the refineries they have on the Texas Gulf and 4,000 miles of pipeline all around the U.S. But then recently, the news broke when we found that they actually have over 1 million acres up in Alberta, Canada, not far from where that pipeline is supposed to begin. And the economics are that that is the third largest fossil fuels reserve on the planet up in Alberta. You've got Venezuela, you've got Saudi Arabia, and then you've got Alberta, Canada. And so what lacks in getting that stuff to the market is it doesn't have the infrastructure, the pipelines, the rail capacity. Keystone would be the key to that whole takeaway strategy of the product to get it to market. So that's why it's become so critical for environmentalists and others, Native First Nation folks in the region, to stop this pipeline, because it sort of Katie bar the door with exploiting the rest of the resource.
And your study, pretty clear that this is not just public spiritedness on the Koch brothers' part. They stand to make a nice, pretty penny on this, don't they?
Yeah, we just used industry analyst projections for what the land was going to be worth and the barrel per acre and crunched the numbers. And originally we had heard from one of the Koch's own geologists that they had 2 million acres up there. So we projected that they're making $100 billion from the Keystone Pipeline.
That starts to be real money, doesn't it, Victor?
Well, they currently have $100 million. If you go by Bloomberg's Billionaires Index, they have more money together, $100 billion, than anybody on the planet. Bill Gates is at 79. George Soros, who you hear about a lot, I think is at 36 billion. Still a lot of money, but these guys have triple that. And they have 40 years of building up their influence network and more money than anyone to burn. And they certainly have a clear idea what they want, and that's to get government out of the way, to continue to produce fossil fuels on the planet cost-free.
And that helps explain some of the huge financial contributions there various front groups and organizations are making in these elections, doesn't it?
Well, it's really the only way we can explain it. You know, why would somebody give so much to shape the political process? Okay, well, they have a lot at stake. So we see that they have, and this is another report we did before the Keystone one, showing that the Kochs have outspent every other oil company in the U.S., even Exxon, when it comes to campaign contributions, when it comes to direct lobbying expenditures, when it comes to funding all that phony junk climate denialist science, $61 million just for the phony science stuff. Then it comes to the other groups that they have, the think tanks and the astroturf agents and the media manipulators. People can go on to the website that we set up called Koch Cash. That's C-O-K-H. Sounds like Coca-Cola, but it's, sorry, K-O-C-H. K-O-C-H. Koch Cash. K-O-C-H-C-A-S-H.org. And see something on there we set up called the Coctopus. Kind of an interactive.
The Coctopus, that's a good one, huh?
not a word we made up, but it's really about their influence network. And I think Americans, once they see this thing, it reminds them from the American oligarchs of last century. So we actually see these guys as having more power than Rockefeller or any other American had. You know, Rockefeller never got elected such an extremist set of in what you have in the House right now and the Senate, the GOP leadership. They shut down the government last fall. They were threatening to stop raising the debt ceiling unless they tied the Keystone XL pipeline's immediate passage to paying the bills, and they wouldn't extend unemployment benefits. And now they're holding hostage this energy efficiency bill, which has bipartisan support, but they want their pipeline first. So.
Well, and of course, people forget because the Kochs are getting so much publicity for their contributions. I mean, their money comes directly from these things, oil exploration, pipelines, refineries. This is their prime squeeze, isn't it?
It is. It's a family fortune built on fossil fuels. You know, their father, Fred, was born in Port Arthur, but invented, or rather innovated, on refinery technology. People have probably heard of fracking, but Father Fred helped to invent what's called cracking, and that's what turns crude oil into gasoline. Now, he doubled the net energy, and it was so innovative that Rockefeller sued him for it for patent infringement. And while he was going broke defending his patents, he went to Stalin's Russia and built all of his industrial capacity and his refineries for the communists. But everybody he trained, every engineer, ended up getting purged by the Stalinists. So that's when Father Fred came back to the U.S., hating communism, and helped to start something called the John Birch Society, which people may know is a very strong anti-communist, in some cases aligned with other racist elements in the country, or rather seem to attract a certain type of person. But the John Birch Society is still the same mentality and same narrative that runs through today's Tea Party. You know, shrink government, the United Nations is an international socialist takeover. Those sort of sensibilities are still what guides the Koch's thinking and followers today.
Now, when we talk about making $100 billion, How many years will that take for them to make that kind of haul?
I think we projected that out at about 30 years, which is about what, they project that the tar sands could be exploited for when they look at how much they got up there. There are even projections going in the 50, but of course we look at the floods and tornadoes and droughts that are happening in the country, and then one wonders if we will actually be using fossil fuels that far into the future, because we just don't have physical space in our atmosphere to put all that carbon anymore. That's why it just doesn't make sense to build that pipeline or to exploit those tar sands, because there just isn't space in our polluted atmosphere to put it. It has to stay in the ground. We have all sorts of other solutions for producing reliable, renewable, local energy, not just the renewables like solar and wind and so on, but all the efficiency technologies and so on. Of course, that's a direct threat to selling more fossil fuel that the Kochs and others would profit from.
And well, and we're getting, go ahead.
In the area, I was just going to say, they do sell a lot of fossil fuels, but where they make their big money, Wade, is in the trading of the derivatives and the different financial instruments associated with the sale of the oil. So that's how they quintupled their wealth from $10 billion to $50 billion in about 6 years, from 2006 to 2011. And people who look at those sort of skyrocketing numbers say you can only do that with derivatives. So the oil derivatives index is something the Kochs invented with one of the big Wall Street banks, and they are still one of the biggest players in that whole derivatives market. That ends up costing people money at the pump. Even the Federal Reserve and Exxon, Goldman Sachs says that about 20-25% of what people pay at the pump is due to speculation and the trading that goes on of the oil derivatives instruments. So that's where their big money is made. It directly leads to people paying at the pump.
Well, and that's the point that this economist Thomas Pinckney is getting so much publicity about in terms of the exacerbation of inequality. The rich get richer. And, hey, I guess if you got $10 billion, you got a good head start on how you get to $100 billion. And now these guys, if they're sitting at $100 billion, are looking at the $200 billion. But let's talk about the election season here, because right now, and we talked about this recently, Senator Mary Landrieu from Louisiana tried to, over the last couple of weeks, get a bill forward. She had people's support, including Senator Pryor from Arkansas, who were under a lot of attack ads from the Koch brothers. And they'd hoped clearly to put it to a vote of the Senate. Now, it looks like they don't have the votes and it's not going forward, but let's catch people up to date with where the approval process is on Keystone XL right now.
Yeah, well, it's certainly not over. Never over till it's over. The article I saw yesterday with Senator Landrieu said she was still two votes shy, and that's up from being six votes shy just last week. The Kochs and others say they're pulling out all the stops. They've got their list of senators, and you're right, they're just hammering them in those districts. So the fight continues right now. What's sort of in play is Landrieu has gotten Senator Reid, who is repeatedly warning the country that the Kochs are trying to buy America, got Senator Reid to agree to put it to a vote. So up or down on Keystone, they don't know if they have the 60 votes, but he knows that to keep controlling the Senate, Landrieu has to get reelected. So he's letting her have that vote and see if they can get the 60 votes. So we'll see.
And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday saying that the Republicans were now softening up on the vote because Reid had declared there could be no amendments to the bill. If Landrieu was able to get it to a vote, it had to go up exactly as it was. And the Republicans are squeamish about that. And at least the Journal report is that she just doesn't have the votes and it's unlikely to come to vote. We can't tell. But the real problem is right now, the process is such that the Secretary of State, John Kerry, because this is really a bi-national situation to approve a pipeline of this, everything has been postponed, theoretically, waiting for the outcome of lawsuits in Nebraska that would establish right away for the pipeline. And essentially, the Senate play, as you and I understand it, I think is a if and when kind of thing. If Senator Landrieu, for her oil and gas supporters, can get a vote, they'd only be passing something if and when the Nebraska courts say that you can go forward. So this is all a complicated mess, and whether or not they can seize control from the executive branch and the State Department, and whether or not they even have the legal authority to do this seems to be somewhat questionable, huh, Victor?
Well, I absolutely. The more we look into it, what's curious about what Landrieu is pushing is that her bill would actually override President Obama's process for trying to make a decision. They've gone through the State Department and all these different comments and negotiations and so on, and they thought they were close to something. And then, like you said, this court in Nebraska said it's unconstitutional the way they took people who were going to take people's land away. But now what it shows is the desperation. Whoever wants this pipeline through, they're willing to override the president's process. A lot of senators have a problem with that, but a critical mass may be willing to do it because they are supporting, or rather they get money and they believe in the economics of this pipeline. Now, if we push harder their way, what I think is interesting is, you know, big oil is blamed for the ones pushing the Keystone XL pipeline. But I think if you break that down, you know, what we showed in our research, Koch has the most acreage up there. They have the most skin in the game, the most carbon in the ground they want to get out, the most at risk, if you will. Chevron, Exxon, Conoco, the other big U.S. oil companies who have pull in Washington, don't have nearly the acreage that Koch has up there. So when we wonder who's really pushing this stuff, you know, we see Exxon and Chevron back in February when the Tea Party was saying, you know, we're not going to raise the debt ceiling limit. We're going to hold something. We're going to attach some amendment or some provision just to pay our bills. They then were talking about putting the Keystone XL pipeline. Chevron and Exxon came out against that.
Mm-hmm.
They've come out against a few times the way people have tried to tie Keystone to the budget bill, shutting down the government. They're just not that desperate to get it, but somebody seems to be, and it seems to be the Tea Party people who are pushing it the most. Now, Chevron gave to conservatives, but they gave only to moderate conservatives with their campaign contribution. They didn't help get elected these extremists that are pushing the pipeline, refusing to extend unemployment benefits unless the pipeline is tied to it, all this sort of crazy stuff. They seized at least a critical mass of control of the government, the power of the purse, and so on. And they seem to be really desperate to push through this pipeline.
We're talking to Victor Minotti, who's the executive director of the International Forum on Globalization. They did a path-breaking report on the carbon impact and the Koch brothers' role in trying to get through Keystone XL, the huge pipeline that has been proposed to move heavy tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, all the way to the Gulf Coast through Beaumont and Port Arthur Refinery. See, Chevron is one of our heroes. That's a stretch, too. But, you know, with all the Koch brothers are doing to essentially...
Well, that's why I want to be careful there, Wade. Sorry, I'm not trying to say that Chevron or Exxon are the good guys.
Oh, I understand. But it points out how, I don't want to say the word greedy, but it seems to be greedy, how the Kochs really seem to be willing to throw everything against the wall just to get this thing done for their own pocketbook.
Well, what I think has happened now is maybe they think the jig is up, that we've outed how much acreage, how much they have at stake there, and they really need to get that thing through now. So like their lobbyists at the American Petroleum Institute said, all their options are on the table. They are calling on all their chits here to get this thing through, and it may be now or never for them. Now, that may have been the case 6 months ago when they shut down the government and tied Keystone in there. You know, people only heard about that it was about Obamacare, the individual mandate, the medical device tax. The other condition in there, there were four conditions that were in the budget bill that shut down the government. It was those two on Obamacare. The other two, there was a Keystone XL pipeline, and it was eliminating the EPA authority over regulating carbon pollution. You didn't hear as much about those. But that's the level of desperation that Koch has to puts this pipeline through.
You know, it's sort of a head-scratcher. As partisan as the Koch brothers' expenditures have been politically, why you would even, you know, they seem to have the Democrats with a death mask in their view and a target on their back. Why in the world you'd see support of any kind for this kind of hurry-up personal aggrandizement for the Koch brothers through this pipeline? None of it just adds up.
Well, the calculation that we think they're making is they have this ultra-dirty carbon in the ground. They see the climate going crazy. You know, they're not denialists themselves. They're skeptics. Charles Koch is what he told Forbes magazine. And they're just going to make the science really tough to settle. But I think they see the writing on the wall that there's going to be a price put on carbon. They've got these assets up there that they'll be worth much more money if they can get them out of the ground and create the infrastructure for it. So it's money in the bank, or rather money in the ground, that they're trying to get out of the ground in Alberta and into their own bank accounts. That seems to be the motivating force. Surprise, surprise.
Well, and the other contradiction is it's pretty clear that more constraints are being put. I noticed that they're now going to require emergency responders to be notified in every state that a railroad passes through if it's carrying oil sands oil in its tank cars, just because of all the problems we've had, Pennsylvania, Arkansas, Michigan, with oil spills on the railroad tracks. So it's not like there aren't other ways for them to get their product down to wherever they're trying to get it, are there?
It's true, but we also don't want to get caught there in a false dilemma that the industry is trying to put us in, and they're saying, well, you know, that stuff is going to get out of the ground either by rail or by pipeline one way or the other because the market wants it. And that's just not true. If you look at what Wall Street is saying and energy investors are saying, is that that dirty tar sands is so remote from the markets that might use it, which isn't so much the U.S. market, it's foreign markets. They want
right.
to export that stuff. That without these pipeline, the Keystone XL pipeline and other infrastructure, it's not going to be profitable to go up there and exploit that ultra-dirty, ultra-remote stuff. So the economics are that they need this transport infrastructure like the Keystone XL pipeline, and like it's called, it is the keystone of the whole strategy, the takeaway strategy. But don't buy this idea that if there aren't pipelines, the pipelines are going to be safer, they say, than rail. And if we don't have those pipelines, they're going to be, you know, the stuff's going to come out of the ground anyway. That's not true. There's a good chunk of it that could stay in the ground if the pipelines and the other infrastructure doesn't get built. It's just not going to be profitable to exploit.
Well, and we had oil shale. I was actually raised in oil shale country in western Colorado for a while and that area of Wyoming. God, I remember when there was a boom there 25 years ago, they all thought their towns were going to explode. There was, you know, because the price per barrel was so high, but they still haven't figured out a way to really make oil shale profitable in that area. What else is the International Forum on Globalization doing, Victor?
Well, other than trying to stop this pipeline.
Oh, yeah, but then that's probably a full-time job, but I want to make sure people know about your full program.
Sure, sure. Well, the point of the program is to call public attention to the emergence of these ultra-wealthy individuals of undue influence who are wielding their wealth to manipulate our democratic political process in this country. Now, we know that's gone on for a long time, but between both, like I said, the globalization's extreme concentrations of wealth and power, a few recent Supreme Court decisions, like Citizens United and the recent McCutcheon ruling that have liberated money and equated it with speech, it's given people with money way more power in the political process than they've ever had before. So it's, it's open shopping season for the Kochs. And this isn't quid pro quo sort of bribery stuff. You know, we'll give you a few box tickets at the 50-yard line. What they've got here is a very clever I call it almost like a farm team. You know, they cultivate these ideologues from the grassroots groups that they have around the country. Often they're frustrated businessmen who have had some bad experience with government regulation. But they get these people ideologically aligned and then provide them with the political support, the training, communications, the, you know, the campaign teams and the television advertising, and get them elected. So once it's not like once they're elected, they need to continue to pay them off, although they'll support them, because these people are ideologically aligned with what the COPES program is all about, and that's get government out of the way, let people pollute, you know, let economic freedom reign, and that the power of capital is what should take priority over people's health, over the planetary health. Those are the ideas they want to institutionalize in the rulemaking of this country. They've got quite a few of them already in place, and the only thing we think that can reverse that, this is the other part of our work right now, is, you know, it's kind of what do you want to call it, Wade? Organizing 101. You got to get the people without the power organized. Something about the people with the power. In this case, we see so many people who are fighting folks because, you know, they're financing this fight against women and taking away reproductive rights. Same thing with workers in Wisconsin and other states across the country trying to stop the minimum wage, trying to undermine unemployment benefits. You know, giving money in California secretly to silence our union election. So on all these different fronts, they're throwing money and rolling back people's rights. So the other piece of our work is to get those groups together and to really see who our common opponent is and to make a plan not only for the upcoming elections, but beyond that, to really replace these guys with a seriously democratic process and something more representative of what people actually need and people want for their lives. So that's the plan.
Well, that's God's work. You also have a big program in Asia and the Pacific, right?
Yes.
You want to give people a little taste of that before we go?
Absolutely. I mean, I like to think that IFG is dealing with the two biggest power shifts in the world right now. The first one I'm going to talk about is the shift to these ultra-wealthy individuals and plutocrats. That's our plutonomy program. The other is the Asia-Pacific pivot, which is the shift in U.S. military and commercial power from the Atlantic to the Pacific, mainly to deal with the rise of China and to try to encircle China. So what you see right now in the U.S. is both an expansion of our military bases in Okinawa, Japan, or in Jeju, South Korea, an island 500 miles from Beijing, and you don't even hear that we're trying to put a nuclear submarine base there with the South Koreans. The island of Guam, a new base in Australia. So all of this is sort of keep China, who's, you know, on the rise, expanding economically, and you've probably seen is doing some really pushing out its own, what do I want to say, not its borders, but at least trying to define new space for itself in the South China Sea, around the Philippines and Vietnam. And the other day, there is some footage of them batting, you know, bumping their boats into the Vietnamese fishermen. The Chinese oil companies are trying to drill in that area. So it is potentially a flashpoint for U.S.-Chinese conflict. The U.S. controls the sea space there a lot. The other piece is the trade agenda, the Trans-Pacific Partnership that President Obama just went through and trying to finalize. So that's our other big program, is trying to get U.S. grassroots groups and the American public aware of what this Pacific pivot is all about, our government is trying to do, and to see if there's not another path forward, because we see it leading to a possible real ugly confrontation with China. Not good.
As you can tell, we've been talking to Victor Minotti, the executive director of the International Forum on Globalization, and he's got his plate full, as well as everybody involved in IFG. How do you get support, and how can people find you before we call off for another week?
Well, we have a lot of very small donors, you know, $25, $35 people who support us. We have a few private foundations that support our work. Not many family foundations want to step out publicly against Charles and David Koch. But if people do want to donate or just check out anything we do, you can see ifg.org. That's International Forum on Globalization, ifg.org. Or check out that Koch Cash website we set up, kochcash.org.
Thank you, Victor. This is Wade Rathke with Wade's World. Next Friday, we're going to go back into the Wilbur Mills Expressway. There's a new study trying to expand it. We'll be talking to somebody about the Wilbur Mills campaign. This is Wade's World, www.kbf.org, 88.3, People Power. See you next week.